Bernie Madoff conducted what was likely the largest global Ponzi scheme in history. In such frauds, the perpetrator is continually seeking out new investors to pay the earlier investors. They are houses of cards that eventually collapse. The collapse of Madoff's fraud left some 16,000 victims and actual losses of at least $20 billion. They included ultra-wealthy celebrities, but also retirees who lost their homes and pensions, as well as university endowments and large philanthropic organizations. Diana B. Enriquez is a veteran reporter for The New York Times. When Madoff was arrested in December 2008, and she learned that it was his sons who turned him in, she immediately sensed the Shakespearean proportions of the story. It has all the elements of a great tragedy: betrayal, ruin, revenge, hubris, and even suicide, including Madoff's own son, Mark. Enriquez's new book is The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. Talk about the title of the book.
Originally, the working title was A World of Lies. That appealed to me because it seemed to capture what made this Ponzi scheme so historic. It really was the world's first global Ponzi scheme. Ponzi schemes, by definition, almost never reach beyond the personal circle of the Ponzi schemer. It's a face-to-face crime. It's a crime where the fraudster earns your trust, usually customer by customer. This Ponzi scheme stretched from Palm Beach to the Persian Gulf, and the way it did so was that Madoff kind of hijacked other people's credibility, and his ultimate victim may not ever have heard of Bernie Madoff or trusted Bernie Madoff, but they trusted somebody who trusted somebody who trusted somebody who trusted Bernie Madoff. And that chain of trust that could stretch all around the world was a genuinely new thing for a Ponzi scheme. So A World of Lies seemed like the right thing. But then when I met Madoff in prison and realized how remarkable he was as a Ponzi schemer, not just that the Ponzi scheme itself was unusual, but he as a Ponzi schemer was so remarkable and had this magical magnetism that needed to be understood and explained, I wanted to put him at the center of it.
And you talked about the death of trust on many levels.
That is really what made this such a compelling story. It was about trust bestowed and trust betrayed. And it just happened to occur in finance. It happened to occur through a Ponzi scheme. But we bestow our trust and we are betrayed in any number of human circumstances. And so that really made it so universal. And that's why that the damage that Madoff did to the capacity of his victims and the rest of us to trust one another, to trust our regulatory institutions, to trust Wall Street, to trust our financial advisors, to trust anything, was so devastating that I thought that needed to be part of the story.
Why was he so charismatic? He wasn't flashy.
He wasn't the glad hander, the swashbuckler, the bon vivant in the corner buying everybody drinks and telling funny stories. That's the classic Ponzi schemer, and I've known half a dozen like that. That isn't Bernie Madoff, and it wasn't Bernie Madoff. He is a soft-spoken, self-deprecating, reserved sort of guy. His favorite evening out would have been dinner with Ruth, not some big gala, not some big party where he's holding forth. And I think that disarmed people. I think people who would have been automatically suspicious of the classic Ponzi personality couldn't imagine that this low-key guy could be a Ponzi schemer. He had a gift for making you feel like you were the most fascinating, interesting person he'd met. The classic Ponzi schemer wanted you to think he was the most fascinating, interesting person you'd ever met, and Bernie just turned that on its head. So it was a remarkable emotional jujitsu that he played on these investors.
Did you feel this at all when you met him for the first time?
Very much so. I mean, in retrospect, I can laugh about it. And I laughed about it pretty quickly. But I have to say, at the time when I was interviewing him in prison, I was not quite aware that he was using this jujitsu on me. I had very limited time to ask him the questions that I had that I wanted to ask. And so he took a digression into explaining some financial strategy that I already knew about. I didn't need to waste a minute on that. So I waved him on and said, I know how that works. Thanks. Well, he just casually turned to his lawyer with this little smile and he said, oh, it's such a pleasure to talk to someone who really understands the markets. I felt great. I felt wonderful. I mean, he made me feel like I was the most intelligent, best informed reporter he'd ever met. And so I know from personal experience how good that feels, how disarming that is. Now, it didn't take me long to remember, this is Bernie Madoff. This is how he does it. This is his magic touch. Watch and learn. So it didn't last for long, but it really was amazing to see the way he sprinkled pixie dust on me and made me feel so special.
He had a legitimate business. He'd been chairman of the NASDAQ. He revolutionized trading on Wall Street. What role did that play in helping him perpetuate this fraud?
It was critical, I think, to him carrying this fraud off for as long as he did. If all he had been was a money manager, he would never have had the kind of credibility that he had with regulators and with other people on Wall Street. But that was no one even knew he did that. That was a tiny piece of his background.
I know it's complicated, but could you explain briefly what a hedge fund is, why this was key to how he built this worldwide Ponzi scheme?
A hedge fund is a form of pooled investment, basically. All of us know pooled investments if we own mutual funds. Same thing. But hedge funds are managed a little differently, and the fee structure is different, and they are regulated differently. A hedge fund is a private collective investment fund. It doesn't have to report to anybody what it's doing. Its investors are presumed by law to be sophisticated investors with ample wealth to know what they're doing. And as long as a hedge fund complies with the rules in terms of who it's marketing itself to and how it's doing that, not trying to sell itself to the general public, not trying to advertise and attract new investors, then it really is free of most of the disclosure requirements that traditional mutual funds have to fulfill. That keeps it, again, below the radar of regulatory interest. So they were really only appropriate for people who could be their own policemen, who could read the documents themselves and assess the risks themselves. They were not appropriate for people who relied on the rules and regulations to make sure that the investment was honest.
You're listening to Women's Focus on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick, and this is an interview with Diana B. Enriquez, author of The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. Enriquez said the evolution of the hedge fund market opened the way for many more people to become victims of Madoff's fraud.
In the great bull market days of the late 80s and the early 90s, and particularly in the late 90s, hedge fund performance was off the charts. Now, they were taking extraordinary risks to get those returns. There is an ironclad connection between risk and returns. So you were taking a lot of risk and you were getting paid to take it with these extraordinary 80%, 100% annual returns. The academic idea began, and I think this idea was actually originally rooted in academia. The notion said, why should the average investor who's saving for retirement be penalized with the puny returns you can get in public mutual funds? There actually is a well-documented movement I call hedge funds for everybody, where the notion came that, you know, people are sophisticated enough to manage their own investments. Let's empower them all. Let's lower the barriers required to invest in hedge funds. At the same time, we had the housing bubble. Now, federal regulations established a minimum net worth that you had to have to be allowed to invest in a hedge fund by law. But as the housing bubble pushed up the value of your home, more and more and more Americans, if you counted your home equity, could qualify for hedge funds. The saddest of those are investors who actually mortgaged their homes to invest with Madoff. And when the Madoff fraud collapsed, they not only lost all their savings, but they lost their homes as well. People with some wealth began to be attracted by these extraordinary returns and were not sufficiently informed or careful about the extraordinary risks that went with those returns and began to find hedge funds more and more attractive. And that's why you saw so many middle income and middle upper income investors putting their pension and retirement savings into feeder funds that were ultimately invested with Bernie Madoff.
A lot of nonprofits lost their endowments, and that included Elie Wiesel. You have an instance in your book. Were you at that event where he spoke?
I was.
Can you talk a little bit about it?
It was one of the most solemn moments, really. This was a breakfast event that was held not long after Madoff's arrest. Feelings were still very raw. And one of the people at this breakfast asked Elie Wiesel whether he could ever forgive Madoff. If Madoff were there in front of him and had asked his forgiveness, would he be able to forgive Madoff? And there was this long pause. Could have heard a pin drop while we waited for his answer. And when he said no, I kind of felt my heart break a little. Mm. That this man who had forgiven so much of the 20th century's savagery, had been so injured, had been so betrayed by this scandal, that at that moment, he did not feel he could forgive Bernie Madoff. For me, it was a marker. It was a milepost in how far down that road of betrayal we felt like we'd traveled. So it was a really moving moment. But certainly it was a moment that that captured a lot of how the Jewish philanthropic community felt about the Madoff scandal. To the extent that any good could have come out of the dreadful losses that so many worthy institutions experienced, I think Madoff did force many philanthropic institutions, both in the Jewish community as well as broader, to look at how they were managing their investments. They were going far too much on faith. They were relying far too much on who knew who. They were relying far too much on the generosity of their donors to guide them, and did not have enough in the way of firm rules and regulations.
Does Madoff know when he's lying?
I've wondered about that. I honestly do. Certainly, I saw him lie to me about whether or not he would give competing interviews, and he seemed perfectly sincere when he broke those promises and explained to me how it had come about. He always had some exculpatory explanation about how he really had never intended to actually break that promise, but things had happened that brought that about. When someone is so gifted at lies, I think you have to assume that they're just as good at lying to themselves as they are at lying to everybody else. And I think the first person Bernie lied to was Bernie. And he lied to himself about what he was doing. He lied to himself about whether he'd be able to get out of it. He lied to himself about how much harm it would cause. He lied to himself about how it would end. I think the lies he told himself were the first step in this enormous web of deceit.
What about his victims? What is the status in terms of recovering some of what? I knew this was a huge issue about who gets paid, who should be paid, and how much they could recover to actually pay anybody.
The bankruptcy trustee has already recovered $10.6 billion, and that's through out-of-court settlements with people he sued, the sale of assets, including the trading platform that was Madoff's legitimate business. So the cash losses in this fraud, that is the sum total of all the money people gave Bernie and never took back, is about $17 to $20 billion. Well, right now, today, we're looking at a potential recovery then of at least 50 cents on the dollar. Historically, if you can get 5 cents on the dollar in a Ponzi scheme, it's a miracle. Now, there is a great division a fierce, sad, tragic division among the Madoff victims between those who gave money to Bernie and never took anything back, lost everything, not only their paper gains, but their actual cash. And then those people who gave money to Bernie and drew money out over the years thinking it was their profits, and through that process retrieved all of the actual cash that they'd given Bernie, but still sustained these enormous paper losses. Now, of course, they feel like losers. They feel like victims. They thought they had $5 million saved for retirement, and it's all gone. Worse than that, over the years, they took $2 million out of their Madoff account, and they'd only put $500,000 in. And now maybe the trustee wants them to give that $1.5 million in fictional profits back. Well, of course they're outraged. You know, there's no right or wrong here. There's no fair or unfair. It's the way the law works. But the people who haven't even gotten their cash back yet, look at the people who have and say, how lucky were you? Why should you get any more money before we at least get back what we gave Bernie? So we should be first in line. And that battle has been one of the most heartbreaking things I've had to cover. It's going to continue on through the courts for years, but that's the tragedy of a Ponzi scheme. Every fraud pits the villain against the victim. Ponzi scheme is the only fraud that pits one victim against another victim.
Diana B. Enriquez is the author of The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. The second half of the interview is coming up. I'm Megan Kamrick, and I know you support this kind of in-depth programming on KUNM, so I'm asking you to show that support now and call in your pledge.